This is tape 4, side 1 of The Impersonal Actor. Defining what to act. There was a production of Sam Shepard's A Lie of the Mind performed some time back at one of the premier houses on the West Coast. Listen carefully to this example. It is kind of tricky, but much will be gleaned from it. In Act 1, Scene 3, Jake tells Frankie, his younger brother, why he had to beat up his wife. This time he believes killing her. In fact, she survives, but with extensive, if occasionally funny, brain damage and notable changes in her behavior. The actor playing Jake, who spent the first scene acting insane, that was in this instance done by screaming a lot, now continued screaming a lot in scene 3, despite the fact that Shepard says absolutely nothing at all about screaming. He does indicate a brewing passion, but nothing at all about screaming. The screaming, not to exaggerate, went on seemingly forever. People in the audience were looking at each other as though they were missing something, and was apparently an attempt on the part of the director to portray the anger and frustration which Jake felt toward his wife. So the director and the actor chose anger and frustration as the thing to act, anger and frustration. Why? Is there any doubt in our minds that he was feeling frustrated and angry? What other feelings would have caused him to put his wife in the hospital with a severe head injury? Scene 3 was written to give us insight into what drives Jake to the rage which has now done so much damage, and into the circumstances which can propel any insecure personality to feel threatened enough to kill. So, why act angry? Scene 3 was written so that we may understand what made him do what he did. It was not written to reiterate his feelings of anger and resentment, which we already know. That's why we say that anger, here and elsewhere, is usually not that which is to be acted. For what angers a character is also what usually angers us, and so we know when a character is angry. Let's look at Shepard's italics. Jake stays seated, stays slow, low, deliberate, builds, stands, moves around space, gains momentum. Then look at the writing. What is there to act is not what is known, which is that he's angry, crazed. That goes without saying. He didn't beat up his wife in a state of euphoria. Isn't it more likely, more logical, more dramatic and effective to assume that something else is being exposed here, other than the original emotion which drove him to his heinous act in the first place? We're talking dramatic theory here. We have to be logical. Yes, he is still experiencing the same feelings, but you have to ask yourself, what is it he is doing or communicating? For that is the actable thing, the thing for you to act. Your job as an actor is a great deal more complex than merely being an expressor of emotion. Your job, as often as not, entails your acting what your character is communicating, regardless of what he or she is thinking and feeling. The reason this is true is both literary and dramatic, and that is that it's simply a great deal more interesting and intriguing for an audience to know what a character is feeling, but what they are watching is what he is doing because of or in spite of those feelings. And that's just the way it is. This reflects what goes on in life, which is that often our feelings about something are secondary to a greater issue, and that being that we have to get on with things, and in life we do, as we must in acting. Getting back to the example, it isn't to be acted that Jake feels angry, because that is what we know. What we don't know is what he's going to do with that now. So then, you go right on to see in the material that what is actable is that he feels justified in doing what he did. That he had to do it, from his point of view. You can almost hear it in my voice, right? He was practically forced to beat her to death. That she brought it on herself. It isn't news that he's angry. What's news is that he thinks he had a right to do what he did. You hear the difference? And hearing him communicate this, that he thinks he had a right to do it, is horrifying because he is in effect saying with great defiant humor that she made him do it. Now that is dangerous and truly sick, an intriguing psychological portrayal. What should have been played was a man who is capable of great violence and then capable of rationalizing it. A dangerous combination and a moving one. As though daring anyone to think differently about the event. The line sounding something like, "She deserved it." Which do you think Sam Shepard wrote, a one-dimensional madman or someone who is mentally ill, who experiences rage and justification and then profound regret? There is nothing to watch if all the humanity is gone. In fact, at the end of the scene, he collapses in a breakdown because he has run out of justification and is paralyzed by what he's done. So now take a moment and visualize the scene acted intelligently. Visualize Jake as a man full of apparent sanity, having humor, insight, wit, irony, talking increasingly, or as Shepard has written in the italics, building, increasingly about how he was justified in doing what he's done. What is acted is a man defying anyone who would question the justness of his actions, but what is perceived, because he does that, is a man who's on the very brink of madness. You see, it's at the very core of good acting to understand this philosophy that the actor often does one thing so that the writing will be accurately perceived in another importance, that we first understand what it is the writer wishes to have perceived. Understanding this, we can then realize the experience he's placed on the page and consequently the proper impact it will have on the viewer. This is not only a director's job, but the actor's. The famous French playwright and philosopher Denis Diderot said, "The poet, the novelist, the actor appeal to the heart by indirect means. The effect depends upon the extent the heart is open to receive impressions." The drama and the actor rarely have a one-to-one relationship. The actor rarely acts what his character is feeling so that the audience will feel what his character is feeling. If it were as simple as this, there would be very little writing that went past the boundaries of preaching. In Beyond Therapy, that comedic work of genius by Christopher Durang, in the scene between the psychiatrist Charlotte and Bruce's roommate Bob, where she suddenly starts hurling one particular epithet at Bob over and over, what is to be acted is her horrified delight and her fathomless surprise with the things coming out of her own mouth, not with the effect the insults are having on Bob. In this way, we see someone who is not cruel and petty and mad who became a psychiatrist, but someone who would be a very good psychiatrist were it not that she's given at times to losing her mind. What is acted is the genuine surprise and delight with the words coming out of her own mouth like they were not even her own words. What is perceived, then, is someone basically nice, not basically mean, basically skilled, not basically inept, basically well-intended, not basically malicious. She must be surprised by her own behavior so that we are humored instead of repelled by the thought that this is certainly no person who should be in charge of other people's minds. If she takes delight in the effect her words have on Bob, we are repelled. If we are repelled, we will not laugh, and Durang is famous for making people laugh. What is done always depends on the circumstances. But following is a list of things to be looking for in the writing. We will call them actable perceivables. These are sometimes given to you as stage directions or italics. It's important to remember that italics and stage directions are literature, not acting instructions. When you read a play or a film script, you'll see that in reading the words, something is perceived and pictured in your mind as you read. Italics and stage directions are part of this. Literary descriptions which cause you to receive a further image of what the scene looks and sounds and feels like to the viewer, not what it is that is done to make an audience perceive these things. Italics are not acting instructions. If your focus is on understanding writing from the viewpoint that what is in parentheses is what the audience perceives as opposed to what it is you, the actor, acts, you'll know exactly what to do. You may want to write these down. There are 46 of them listed here, but you will begin to think of their number as infinite. When what is to be perceived is joy, instead of acting joyfully, have delight with everything. When what is to be perceived is sadness, instead of acting sad, have delight with nothing. When what is to be perceived is happiness, instead of acting happy, be content with everything. When what is to be perceived is unhappiness, instead of acting unhappy, be content with nothing. When what is to be perceived is depressed, instead of acting depressed, be without surprise or delight, or look only into a time with none of these. Preoccupation, look into the immediate future or past, or distant future or past. Regret, play how good things can never be. Hopefulness, play how good things could be if only. Longing, play how good things would be if only. Almost. Play how good things might have been, if only. Defiance. Play the righteousness of one's position. Outrage. Make a demonstration of anger. Fear. Look into an immediate dreadful future. Panic. Look rapidly everywhere for a way out. Despair. Look into many futures but see no hope. Obsession. Be always preoccupied. Distracted. Look for what you were just thinking about. Nervous. Look for what's happening next. Anxious. Look for what to do next. Stupidity. Be waiting optimistically for something to make sense to you. Intelligence. Be waiting patiently for something not to make sense. Confusion. Actively look for something to make sense. Bewilderment. Wait for the impossibility in front of you to go away. Desire. Play only the business of getting. Lust. Play only the business of getting sex. Love. Be offering gifts, compliments, or solutions. Concern. Take care of the other and be listening to the other person's every word, spoken as well as not. Grief. Be looking into a loss that cannot possibly be. Shyness. Play that one mustn't dare. Relaxed. Play that everything goes without saying. Exhausted. Play that the least little thing takes an effort. Pain. Be surprised at the extent of it and look for a way out of it. Running out of patience. Be working at remaining calm. An uneasy reunion. Be working at making conversation. Uncertainty. Be looking into the many ramifications. Humility. Be thankful. Sorry. Be without excuse for your behavior. Guilty. Be angry with yourself and without excuse. Agitated. End the scene on each moment and every communication while looking into the immediate future for a solution. Inconsolable. End the scene on each moment and every communication while looking into the immediate future but finding no solution. Madness. Play the inappropriate delight or acceptance of the totally absurd. Arrogance. Show disdain or scorn for another's need to express himself. Begging. Make your plea a good idea while showing submission. Disappointment. Play that this can't be all there is. Suspicion. Be looking at something that probably isn't true. Now again, these play-to-perceive tools are just exactly that, tools for you to use in order to get out of the habit of playing emotion and into the habit of playing action. Acting, action. These are maps to the dramatic experience and as such are intended to help you find the way. They themselves are not the way, but you will find them very useful. Now let's talk about lying. Your character must have the right to lie well. You give yourself the right to lie well, don't you? The only exception is if it's written that your character lies really badly or desires to be detected or is lying for a joke. For dramatic purposes, most prepared lies will be well told and undetectable until later revealed. Most unprepared lies will be well told, but with a minute-second pause before it. A professor from the University of Southern California School of Communication Arts, who teaches nonverbal communication and persuasion, says that the physical bodies of liars often gives them away. Dr. Michael Cody has studied both people who tell prepared lies and people who tell spontaneous lies. When a person readies a statement ahead of time, that's a prepared lie. When he responds untruthfully to an unexpected question, that's a spontaneous lie. Dr. Cody's research at USC showed that people who tell prepared lies tend to give brief answers, give the answer right after the question is asked, nod their heads at the end of their lie, rub their hands together, have tremors in their voices, but this last can only be detected by a machine, may have a tone of voice which is emotionless, like they've said this 100 times. People who told spontaneous lies tend to give brief answers because liars in general have to think about what to say, have speaking errors, two types. One, grammatical errors such as we was, or two, false starts. That is, liars will start off one way, then back up and correct their words, such as then we would. That they tended to pause more often, either silent pauses or pauses filled with ahs, use collective words such as all and every and always and never. It's always like that. Nobody ever does a thing. They resort to meaningless phrases such as, you know, or the usual, or things like that. That what they say lacks detail, and they scratch and rub body parts or completely come to a standstill and freeze. If you agree with the research, you may include these behaviors in the acting of telling a lie, but you must do so in a way so little and true that it would only be perceivable subconsciously to anyone who is not consciously aware of these behaviors. You should lie so that the second time your audience sees the scene, they will say, "Of course," and that has to be a good lie. Dying. Naturally, it makes a great deal of difference what the circumstances are under which your character is giving up life. But whatever they are, it is best for you, in terms of the acting, to think of it as exactly that, an end of life. In this way, you'll be focusing on holding on to life, or letting go of life, rather than dealing with a thing called dying, which we who are living really know nothing about. If your character is holding on to life, then he holds on to it until it's gone. If your character is letting go of life, then he's usually attending to the fears of loved ones at his side. Certainly, the thing which you'll be focusing on getting correct and accurate is the looking and the breathing. Is your character looking willingly into a profound and unknown adventure, or is he looking fearfully into a dark abyss? Is your character holding on to each breath like it were life itself, or is he watching it ebb and flow? If there is pain involved, it can be appropriate in either acceptance or rejection of the end of life, but you will find that more often than not, the thing to be included about the pain is the surprise at the degree of it, rather than acting that it hurts. If it's pain, it already hurts. What's news is the shock of how much it hurts. Another important thing to consider about these scenes is that in good acting, so often there is quite a lot of irony on the part of the near decedent. Irony that it could end so quickly. Irony that it's taken so long. Irony that it hurts so much. Irony that it's relatively painless. Irony that you're leaving broke. Irony that you're leaving rich. Irony that it's such a beautiful day. Irony that it started out so beautifully. There's no end to what ironies may be involved, but it will be clear in the circumstances which exactly they are. And when you add all these ingredients, the looking, the breathing, the pain, the irony, all depending on how the character is meeting the end of life, you'll really start to have something moving to watch. And remember, whether your character is going willingly or not, usually he will do so with a greater or lesser degree of bravery. If it isn't that way, it will be clear in the writing. Playing drunk can be a lot of fun, but frankly, requires an enormous amount of practice to become a master at it. But let's point out a few things which you will be looking for when you do go for it. Of course, there are levels of drunk, from a drink to a few drinks to really bombed, and there are different ways in which your character will be written to be drunk. Some get loud, others go internal, some get belligerent, while others get uncharacteristically friendly. It ought to be clear in the writing as to the kind of inebriation involved. In terms of handling inebriation, determine whether your character has had enough to affect only attitude or whether he's had enough to affect the physical condition as well. Look at the writing to determine whether the drink has brought forth one of three general conditions: A. joyful, B. clouded, C. depressed. Worry about subtlety later. In acting these states, remember that your character should see the world outside of him. That is, the world is joyful, or the world is clouded, or the world is depressing. Remember, the drink has made the world these things. These are not the things felt about the world. If the effect is merely attitudinal, then generally speaking, the joyful world will elicit a great deal of delight, the clouded world will elicit some degree of stupidity, confusion, or bewilderment, and the depressing world will elicit a pretty fair amount of arrogance or preoccupation, or shame or sadness, regret, guilt, and inconsolability with varying degrees of dark irony and humor. Just go down the list. If the effect is also physical, then it's going to get even more fun because you get to add the following. Often there's an expansiveness of expression, allowing for grand verbal and physical gestures. When moving from point A to point B, and your character's motor skills are affected, the key is to head for a target, say a doorway, and midway there be slightly off target. Stop, correct, and then proceed, all like nothing happened, with your head held high. If the effect is also of speech, which is usually the first to go, slurring is good, but it should be in spite of speaking very carefully rather than a result of general sloppiness. Remember, usually when we've had too much to drink, even if we're having a good time, we don't want to be thought of as drunk, unless it's reached the point to where even that is hilarious. If your character is really truly bombed, as in a barfly of ill repute, here is where you can maybe add the unfortunate and occasional silent belches, mid-sentence, preferably after an N sound, as in the word bartender. Then pick up the N that you left off with and continue with the remainder of the word. It takes a little practice to get the hang of it, but you'll find it'll be a lot of fun if you take the time. Think it out, be specific, be subtle, at least until it isn't. Crying. Well, here then is the great bugaboo who of the acting world, if there ever was one. So much has been made of shedding a tear, or as it is commonly referred to, real tears, that it's pretty amazing that anyone can do it at all. First of all, there is nothing about crying or not crying on cue that makes a person more or less an actor. A lot of very good actors cannot for the life of them shed a tear on cue, and many an unskilled actor can do it at the drop of a hat. There is no deservedness or undeservedness connected with an ability to cry. But before we get into some technique for crying, let's discuss some philosophy. If you're going to cry when it's called for, then that experience has to be connected with the human experience of crying if it's going to be truthful and sufficient to the moment. In life, when we cry, it's because we have a reason to, and then generally a desire to hold the tears back so as to not burden others and not to embarrass ourselves. When we cry in the human experience, it's almost never because we're thinking about something sad. It might well be because we're thinking about what might have been, or how much someone didn't deserve to suffer, or about something that was particularly wonderful about someone, or about how it still seems impossible that this or that happened, or about something that wasn't said or was said. The list can go on and on, but almost never do we cry because we're thinking about something sad. We cry out of anger, or defiance, or deep appreciation, or profound gratitude, or longing, or disbelief, or regret. And when these things elicit tears, it is said to be sad. So, to think about something sad, in order to cry, might well elicit tears, but it is not the usual human experience of crying, and will not only not look or be perceived as true, but it will always have about it an air of effortfulness, because the character is trying to cry and is thinking about something sad in order to cry, which we don't do in life. Crying is simple. Your character cries. Don't let anyone tell you that you have to feel like crying in order to cry. In truth, you have to feel like not crying. To cry on cue, first come to an understanding of what is the essence of the tears, as we've just discussed. Then, and this will take some practice and a certain amount of observation, simply do what people do when they cry. And you will be crying. Tears will come. Humans suppress tears, at least at first. So at first, work at suppressing tears. Watch how people do it, that look on their face that comes as they're looking slightly away, casting eyes down and to the side a little. Notice how the breath is held so as not to release a sob. Notice then that it's necessary to catch little breaths, which are quietly held until another breath is needed. Notice how the hands tend to touch the face, now at one moment, now in another, in order to cover the growing tension, and yet how the hand dare not remain there long so as to draw attention to the event. Notice how the essence of such a moment is not self-pity, but bravery. And notice how summoning courage can in fact release a sob, for one cannot at the same time suppress and summon the strength to suppress. And when holding down profound emotion no longer can be done, for the strength to hold it back is no longer greater than the weight and depth of the emotion, one simply sobs. And how after several rapid expulsions and inhalations of air, the breathing begins to balance out again. Sobbing is the release of what has been held in, not an expression of what has been held in. As has been previously discussed, the subconscious mind believes anything repeatedly or emotionally imprinted upon it. And when you do exactly what people do when they cry, you are crying, and tears come. This is the exact opposite of faking it. This is really doing what people do when they cry. If your character cries, this is what he does when he cries. This is the end of tape 4, side 1 of The Impersonal Actor. We'll continue our discussions on side 2.